Welcome to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. We bring together the latest research in linguistics, language acquisition, and biblical studies to better understand the biblical languages and ultimately the biblical text. As always, this episode is brought to you by Biblingo, the premier solution for learning, maintaining, and enjoying the biblical languages. Visit biblingo.org to learn more and start your 10-day free trial.
Welcome to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. I am Kevin Grosso, your host for this episode, and I'm excited to talk with Mark Jung today about his book called A Greek Reader. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
So just a little bit about Mark. He was born in South Korea, but grew up in the States. And after becoming a Christian in middle school, he felt called to ministry while in college, which led to a long path of further studies in New Testament. He is an instructor of Hellenistic Greek and a doctoral student in New Testament at Duke Divinity School. He has published articles on the New Testament in the Journal for the Study of the New Testament and New Testament Studies. And today, like I said, we will be talking about his most recent work called A Greek Reader. So for those unacquainted with the book, can you just tell us what is in it? Just, you know, someone who might just like look at it, they might say, okay, what is A Greek Reader?
Yeah, sure. So it's a book that includes one or two stories per lesson. And the subtitle of the book is Companion to a Primer of Biblical Greek. So it's meant to be a supplement to Croy's Primer of Biblical Greek, which is an introductory textbook. So each lesson of this book, A Greek Reader, has about one or two stories that are tied to the lessons in Croy. And each Greek story has the Greek text on the left. And then on the facing page, there are grammar notes and vocabulary notes. And the grammar and vocabulary is leveled so that for the most part, students won't, or people who read the book won't encounter grammar or vocabulary that they haven't learned yet in Croy. So the aim is kind of to help students to start reading from the beginning and continue to read as they progress through a Greek course.
Yeah, that's great. And I think this is a much needed kind of resource in general. So just a couple of things about it. So when I first heard about it, I was told that it was this sort of like fictional story about Paul and Onesimus. When I actually started reading through it, I realized you actually include a lot of other stories. So can you just tell us like what kind of other stories are included and a little bit about, you know, this storyline with Paul and Onesimus as well?
Yeah. So some of the other stories, they mainly come from the Bible. So there are stories adapted from the Gospels, some stories from the Old Testament involving Moses and Pharaoh. And there are also, I think, a few random stories not from the Bible. But the most part, the main storyline is a story that follows Paul, Philemon, and Onesimus from the beginning when they first meet all the way until Paul is in Rome and he's sending back Onesimus to Philemon. And you know, I stated at the in the introduction that it's not meant to be historical. So if you're kind of tracing your maps and seeing how this actually lines up with the New Testament, I'm sorry, but it's going to disappoint you. But I wanted to have a story where the narrative would work with themes that students would be familiar with and also the vocabulary that students will learn in a New Testament Greek course. And of course, the vocabulary that was already in Croy for each lesson. And in my Greek class, I had wanted to read the letter to Philemon in our second semester. So this was kind of a nice segue into that.
Yeah, that's great. So I guess one question, you're following the storyline, right? But then you're also following Croy's story of Greek at the same time. Right? Mm-hmm. So what did you have in mind when you were thinking about like what stories to include? Was it about, you know, more about constraints and vocabulary, or did you have a specific purpose in mind for, you know, how you chose which stories to include?
Yeah. So I should start out by saying that when I started writing these stories, I wasn't thinking that it would turn into a book. I was teaching Greek to my students. It was my first year teaching Greek, and I wanted some sort of text or narrative that could kind of bring all the different things they were learning together into a format that was entertaining and comprehensible and et cetera, et cetera. So as I was writing those stories, you know, I was definitely limited to the vocabulary and grammar that was in Croy because I didn't want to overwhelm the students. I wanted it to be something that, you know, people using Croy, like the peers in my program who are also teaching Greek, could use in the future. So that was part of what I was thinking. And, you know, a lot of the vocabulary that they learned kind of naturally fit into a story involving Paul and Onesimus and Philemon. So that helped. And I also wanted to try and make the story somewhat entertaining. I should say last year, or I guess it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago now, the year before I taught Greek, I studied Latin for the first time, and I used Lingua Latina, which, you know, is kind of a long book with continuous story. And I was sort of inspired by that to write a story that would be somewhat entertaining. It definitely doesn't reach that level, but I tried. And I also have enjoyed reading, you know, some, you know, Greek texts, like some other Koine texts outside of the New Testament, including like the Greek novels and some apocryphal texts. So I did want to include some like sea travels. So that's kind of part of it towards the end. But yeah, so that's kind of what I was thinking, trying to make it entertaining, but also staying within the vocabulary and grammar of Croy.
Yeah, yeah. And those that are familiar with Biblingo will know that we also have these, you know, original stories that are written kind of like at the student's level. I can say from someone who writes these stories, it is very difficult to have an entertaining story with 100 words. You know, like when you're working with such limited vocabulary, it is just a really big pain to write stories. So I was really impressed, you know, just reading through, you know, some of the stories, just seeing like how natural it was and yeah, how it could actually be an interesting story when, yeah, you're just dealing with, you know, people don't understand how little Greek, you know, at, you know, even 1,000 words is like nothing.
Right.
So anyway, kudos to you for that. And we'll get into more of these details later. So just a couple of more things about the book itself. You repeat some stories with like slight variations. What was the thinking behind this? Why did you do that?
Yeah. So when I was writing the stories, I think part of my thinking was that it was a form of leveling the stories where as students would read one story and then read another story later on that was quite similar to one they had already read with some variations, they would already be familiar with the story. So it would be more comprehensible to them, except now what would be new would be the things that they could learn through the story. So there'd be changes in vocabulary, more grammar added. So I think my thinking was, you know, have them read something they've already read, but now it's a little bit more advanced. And I think that for people who, you know, because some of the editors who were reading the book also asked, like, you know, this feels kind of repetitive. It seems very similar. But I haven't had that experience with my students, because I think if you're sitting down and reading it in one sitting or, you know, reading it back to back, it does seem kind of repetitive. But my students in our classroom, there were at least a few days in between reading. So there was some time between. So it didn't feel as repetitive. And I think that repetition of what they already knew, plus kind of some new grammar and vocabulary, helped them read it and also learn that new vocabulary and grammar.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. One of the reasons why I ask is again, we actually do the same thing in Biblingo. And I think there's a lot of research in the second language acquisition world to support that idea. You know, and some people might say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's repetitive, but it is actually helpful to, you know, reinforce the constructions and vocabulary that they already learned, but also, you know, to present them with slightly new things. It's actually like, you know, kind of the perfect way to review is to do, you know, the same material with slight variations. So yeah, I actually thought I really appreciated that aspect of it. So you said that this textbook is paired with Croy's introductory grammar. How do you recommend it being used with Croy, and can you use it without Croy? Like, and how would you recommend doing that?
So that's a good question. I guess I can share a little bit about how I've used it with Croy. And I'd love to hear in the future, how other instructors are using it with Croy or without Croy. But, when I used it with Croy, I did a few things. And I should say our classroom was mostly a traditional kind of grammar translation approach. That's kind of the approach that, Duke takes. And, I was, or I am a doctoral student, so I fit within that kind of system. So with the stories, what I had students do, one thing I had them do was I would have them translate either the entire story or sections of the stories, because some of the stories, especially later on, get very long. So for those stories, I might have them translate a few lines. And then sometimes I would ask them to submit their translations, but I would always have them read the whole story, whether they translated just a small section. Everyone had to read all the stories. And then in class, we would talk about the story. We would review the story. They would have questions that they would bring to class. So that's one thing that I've done. Another thing that I've done is instead of asking students to submit translations as homework, one thing that I tried the second year, and I know this is anathema to some people, but I asked them to use the English translations in the back as a crutch and read each story as many times as it took to internalize what was happening without having to translate. So I basically told them, read the story in Greek with the help of the English and the notes as many times as you need to be able to just read the Greek and understand it as Greek and understand what's happening. And then they would come to class. I would ask them questions about it. We would talk about the story. And for some of my quizzes and exams, I would actually give them a slightly adapted versions of, big chunks of text in the exam, and I would ask them comprehension questions, both in English or in Greek, and expect them to answer mostly in English, but also sometimes in Greek. And the Greek questions would be pretty simple, like, why did this happen, or who did this, or and sometimes it'd be multiple choice, or they would have to write an answer, and the answer was usually somewhere in the story, but they would have to understand what I'm asking for. So those are some of the things I've done. I think that someone not using Croy, depending on what level they're at, if they're a beginner student, they could in their classroom, if they're in a classroom setting, use the Greek reader as a supplement. The grammar probably won't follow exactly what they're doing in their class, but since the reader has vocabulary notes, it has some grammar notes and grammar tables, and since it also has the English translation in the back, if they haven't started learning participles yet in their class, but a story has participles that they don't understand, I still think it's worth it for them to read it and get exposed. And gradually, as they get more of that input, it'll become more natural for them. So that's one way students could use it without Croy.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think it's, the emphasis on reading is very oddly very unique, because that's really the goal of a lot of students. I mean, that's what they think when they come to Greek, in Hebrew class. They say, oh, okay, like I'm going to be able to read the New Testament in the original language. But there's actually not nearly as much emphasis on reading in many, Greek classes as I think there should be. So just a follow-up question on that. Did you feel like there was a difference when you told your students they had to just read it as many times as possible and try to figure out what the Greek is saying for the Greek, even with the help of English? Did you feel like there was a difference between that and, when you asked students to just translate the text?
I did. The difference was that when I asked students to read the text as many times as they could to understand it without submitting a translation or even writing down their own translation, what the main difference was that students actually read it. I think, students are really busy. They might be taking four classes. If they're translating and having to submit it, and I tell them also not only translate this section, but read the whole story, I think some students will, but then there are some students who won't.
Right.
I found that when I asked students to focus on just reading, almost all the students read the story. And we would read parts of it in class, and you know, I'd ask them questions about it to assess their understanding. And I definitely saw an improvement there with their ability to understand and just the fact that they were reading it.
And this is again something that we've talked about on the podcast, just you know, what translation is, the difference between translating and reading. It's interesting too, because even what we call translating a lot of times is really just glossing. It's kind of like going word for word and saying, like looking it up in the dictionary and saying, oh, okay, this word kind of means this, this word kind of means this. Translating itself really requires reading. I mean, you can't translate a text for, you know, a real text for a modern language without being able to read the text really well in the original language, you know, and then put it in the best you can, you know, into your own language. And so it, really what we're talking about a lot of times when we say grammar translation and you ask students to translate is just something more like glossing, because the act of translating requires an extraordinarily high level of competency in reading first. So yeah, I think that's really great. A few other background questions. What motivated you to write this book? Obviously, there's the motivation of you're teaching Greek and you want students to have comprehensible input. But can you just flesh out this for you personally? Why did you write this book?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned this, but I didn't intend to write a book initially. When I was planning to teach Greek my first year, I was looking at the textbook we used here, which is CROI, and the exercises that are included. And you know, given my own background in learning Greek and Hebrew and also other modern languages, what I knew about language acquisition, I just couldn't bring myself to just have my students learn grammar and translate sentences without any sort of narrative context or input. So when I started by writing very simple dialogues, and some of those we acted out in the beginning of class, like the beginning of the semester, because I think when I started doing it, I envisioned that it would be sort of this more communicative classroom where we would speak in Greek. And eventually that, you know, I realized that's just not going to work with the structure of our class with two semesters. So, you know, I started to write longer stories, and it was after I finished writing those that one of my peers at Duke, he suggested, hey, why don't you share this with Erdmans? Maybe they'd be interested in it. And then eventually, after many edits, it became the book that it is. Yeah, but initially I wrote the book because I really wanted, like, the goal that I set for my students is exactly what kind of you said. I wanted them to be able to, at a beginner level, read the New Testament and Septuagint comfortably. They wouldn't read it perfectly, but they would at least have the practice and the confidence to read on their own, so that they could continue to read and learn and grow in their knowledge of Greek. So that was my goal. And I knew that in order to reach that goal, they needed to read. So that's kind of why I wrote the stories.
Yeah, it's funny, but it's so true. Like, you know, you in order to read, you have to read. It is a skill that has to be developed, right? And I think that's where a lot of our thinking needs to change. You know, you can't learn any other skill without practicing the skill. You know, it just doesn't happen. So whenever you compose texts in, you know, a language that's not your first language, there are challenges involved. So can you tell us what your background is in Greek and what makes you qualified to write original texts in Koine? And this isn't, you know, a challenge as much as just for people to understand, you know, where you're coming from and how you got to the point that you've gotten to.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Yeah, I've been learning Greek to some degree for the past 10 years, probably continue learning Greek the rest of my life. I've read a good amount of Greek in Koine and classical Greek. I've gone through several spoken Koine and Attic Greek curricula, so like the Polis Institute's materials and Biblical Language Center's materials. I've also read through the Athanase book, the Italian version, which I would recommend. It has tons of Greek, simple Greek reading material. I think on top of that, I think what pushed me to want to write more stories and feel like I could was just the awareness of what my students needed. So I think that came from my own experience speaking, you know, a foreign language, and also, you know, learning other modern languages, and just some of the research I had done on language acquisition. I knew this was something my students needed, so I felt like I had to do it. And I also feel like, I think kind of like what you were saying, it's hard for people to write stories when it's in a language that's not their native language. And I definitely felt that as I was writing. But I also think that more people should try to write original texts in a Koine or an Attic Greek, because I definitely think that's something we need more of. You know, there are a lot of these kinds of texts in Latin, or at least a lot more. And I think we need more in Greek. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really think you can't have too many. You know, especially, you know, where we're at, like, we just don't have, we have hardly any. But right. But it is, I mean, when you are first starting to learn a language, you know, what you want is a lot of really good stories on your level. And because you want to continue to be engaged, you know, in the language in a way that isn't gruesome, you know, just like totally boring. And that's been our problem in a lot of ways. It's just that, like, we don't, it's not that we don't have material, it's that we don't have material that's comprehensible on our level and that's interesting. And that's just a huge need that I think this book really helps to address. So along those same lines, what was the most challenging part of writing stories in Koine Greek?
Yeah, I think there were a few challenges. One of them was that, you know, I'm not a native speaker of Koine Greek. So I tried to be as careful as possible to use idiomatic Koine, you know, which meant I was spending a lot of time searching Koine sources, searching TLC or BDAG, you know, lexicon, or LSJ, or other reference grammars to make sure what I was saying was idiomatic. But, you know, I know it definitely wasn't perfect, but doing that required a lot of time. So I think that was the hardest part. It required a lot of time to write on top of taking coursework, like my own coursework as a doctoral student. And also, I feel like it would have been, so it actually, the stories were a lot easier to write as the lessons progressed. So once I got to lesson 20 and onward, it was a lot easier. Once Croy introduced the aorist tense, it got a lot easier. I mean, that was earlier on, you know, but so I guess I say that to say that it's hard to write leveled material. You know, it's hard to write things that limit grammar or vocabulary. So I think that was a particular challenge, not just to make stories that do that and are idiomatic, Koine, but also that are interesting, like you were saying. That was a particular challenge.
Yeah, for sure. I can just say I resonate with all of those things so much. So did you, when you were writing, did you draw, I mean, you just mentioned you were looking up, you know, things in other grammars and TLC. And so were you trying to reflect, you know, New Testament Greek, which is a lower register of Greek, or were you drawing from other Koine sources and, you know, wanted to make it a higher register? Where did you kind of pull from in that respect?
Yeah, I think I was primarily trying to have the stories reflect New Testament Greek, also some Septuagint Greek. So I would say most of the inspiration came from the New Testament and the Septuagint, but also from other places. So, you know, there were some instances where, you know, I used some phrases that aren't found in the New Testament or the Septuagint, but are found in other Koine sources, for example. I think my primary motivation was having students practice what they were learning through the textbook and trying to help them acquire the vocabulary and grammar. You know, so for example, when they learned the passive tense, giving them enough examples where it would start to make more sense to them naturally. So yeah, sometimes that required I look at other sources outside of the New Testament or the Septuagint, but I would say those were the primary sources for inspiration.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, along those same lines, we've touched on this. One of the things you said that you did was, you know, you were constantly looking up different texts and making sure it was, you know, idiomatic Koine. How else did you try to mitigate the possible errors in the text? And what would you say to someone who says, oh, well, you're not a native speaker, you know, let's get native speaker material because there might be errors?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, definitely when I wasn't sure about the use of a verb or, you know, any Greek that I was writing, if I wasn't sure how it was, or whether it was idiomatic, one of the first things I would do would be to see if there were examples of that kind of Greek in Greek sources, especially in Koine sources, but I also searched wider. And I think having that awareness was important. Just because I speak Korean and I've also studied Chinese for a long time, so I know that you can't translate things from Korean, for example, into English exactly, like with verbs and prepositions and other things. Like sometimes when you say something in one language, you just can't use the same verb in another language. It's kind of like what we were talking about, where translation becomes glossing, right? Like it doesn't work between Korean and English, and it doesn't work between English and Greek and Greek and English. So having that awareness forced me to, when I was writing a story and using a certain verb, to ask, okay, would this verb be used here, you know, with this preposition? And I wouldn't always second guess myself, but when I wasn't sure, I would search on TLC or on BDAG or LSJ. And also, I have to say, Erdman's, they had an editorial team that helped a lot, where several people looked through the stories, including Croy himself, you know, and suggested a lot of edits. So that was helpful. Definitely wasn't perfect idiomatic Greek, but I tried my best. And yeah, I think with any kind of leveled, graded material, there's often the sense that, oh, is this really idiomatic? And that sense is especially present because we just don't have a lot of material that's simple Koine. You know, like my daughter reads graded English books, and when I read them, it's like no one talks like this. You know,
right.
No one writes, like no adult is writing English like this, but it makes sense for her comprehension level.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point. Is part of the question, you know, with error is what the purpose is. Like if I know there is a, you know, quote unquote grammatical error, but I'm doing it because the person, you know, who's reading it will understand it better. And then, you know, down the line, they're going to see that's not how you would normally say that. You know, I mean, this is what people bank on when they do write English children's stories, right? They're not trying to introduce, you know, grammatical errors into the English language. They're just saying, hey, we can simplify this. And then we know that over time, as they consume more texts, they're, you know, I think of Dr. Seuss, you know, hop on pop. It's like, you know, there's so many things in that little book. I mean, I read it all, or read these kinds of stories all the time to my kids as well. And it's like, you know, they're gonna correct those things for sure.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really important point here, because like in some ways we're not trying to do something idiomatic always, right?
Right.
At some point we're just doing it to be on the student's level, you know, and certainly that's sometimes, you know, when they know 50 words and two verb forms, it's not going to be idiomatic. It can't right. be, you know, because that's, you know, native speakers would never talk like that unless they're talking to little kids. And that's kind of what we're doing. You know, I mean, it really is in a lot of ways what we're trying to get at.
Yeah.
So I want to just shift gears at this point and talk a little bit about some specific questions about the book, some content questions. And the purpose of this is to see kind of what your thinking is behind some of the choices you made and certain constructions or words and whatever. So I have 10 of these, some about the actual text, like in Greek, and others about grammatical notes that you've written. So one of them is word order. So we're actually doing this series right now on word order in New Testament Greek. And so you have this word order change in lesson 3, story B. This is lines 10 and 22. So your sentences are, hey, basilea mu, hey, thalassa estin, with the estin, the copula at the end, versus, hey, ge estin, hey, basilea mu, where you have the copula in the middle between the subject and the predicate. So this sort of like, you know, change in word order, these are, you know, if you're reading through the story, parallel sentences, same kind of content. Why did you choose to write one with the copula at the end and one with the copula in the middle? Or did you have a reason for that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure how intentional it was on my part when I was writing it, but, you know, as I was looking back, at it, you know, I could think of maybe two reasons why. I mean, I think one of them may have been changing the word order, partly for variety for the students, just to see that word order in Greek is somewhat flexible, you know, definitely more than in English. And that's something that students are unfamiliar with in the beginning. I think another reason may have been was, you know, when I was looking at this story in line 10, the focus of the discourse is Basileia. So the question asked by Gaia before is, Diestin he Basileia su, right? And then Poseidon answers, he Basileia mu, he thalassa estin. So the focus there is Basileia. And then in line 22, Gaia switches the focus to the earth, and she asks, Blepisten ken, egeestin he Basileia mu. Right. So here, I think when I was writing it, I was thinking of, not intentionally or consciously, but as I was writing it, hege came in the beginning because the focus of the discourse here was plepis tengen, like, do you see the earth? The earth is my kingdom. So that's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah, I'm not sure that when I was writing it, I was thinking of the estin. In general, in my stories, I put the copula after the subject.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think, you know, the fact that they are actually in different contexts, right, where you have different things being questioned, I think that actually would change word order in Greek. I mean, and you see this in a lot of languages, you know, where you have movement because of the answer to a question. Yeah, I think that's great. So another question, again, in lesson three, you have the plural of doxa in, this is page 16, line 23. You have telete blepein tas doxas tes basileas. So can you explain why the plural of doxa, the plural is found three times in the New Testament out of 166 occurrences. When I first read it, I said, oh, that's interesting. I was wondering if it was found at all in the plural. And I, you know, checked that it is found three times. It seems like, you know, there are certain environments where mass nouns can be found in the plural. It seems like doxa is a mass noun. So that doesn't mean it can't be found in the plural. It means that there are certain cases, you know, special places where it is. So why did you choose that here?
Yeah, you know, I think I wanted students to practice the accusative plural feminine form. And in this case, the accusative plural feminine of a mixed first declension noun, such as doxa. So like in that sentence, they have lepein tas doxas tes basileas, right? So you have same ending on basileas and doxas. So I wanted them to kind of see that it could have the same ending, but be a different case. And I think, yeah, there were some cases where certain words that I chose were not as common in the New Testament, sometimes by a large margin compared to a different usage. But, you know, especially if I really wanted to use it for instructional purposes, I kind of said, okay, well, it's found three times, so it's there.
Yeah.
At least my Greek will be at least as good as Jude, I guess.
Well, the other thing about, you know, the New Testament is the corpus is just so minuscule that, you know, it really doesn't matter how many times something's found. I mean, it's just, you know, I I've said this before on the podcast, but when people do corpus studies in linguistics, they work with like 50 million words, you know, and in the New Testament, it's just nothing. Anyway, so that's great. So yeah, so basically to teach that certain morphological form. So another question, this is lesson six. I think you start to call the stories like logos. Mm-hmm. So you have logos gamma, page 28, line 2. You have lambanete. And I was struck by this usage. Just didn't know if you... So this seems to be, obviously morphologically, it could be, you know, a present or an imperative. So were you thinking present or imperative here? And, you know, why?
Yeah, so I think... Yeah, I think it's definitely present here. I don't think the future, or sorry, the imperative is introduced yet.
Maybe we could just read the context really quick. Sorry, I didn't have it pulled up. So it says, ho gar theos mu eche oikus en urano kai lambanete tus kalus oikus apo theou. So when I was reading it, I naturally read it as an imperative. I said, okay, you know, God has oikos in Urano. He has, houses in heaven. Again, that's a very literal translation. And then, you know, kailambanate is, so I said, okay, are you telling me to receive those good houses from God? Or are you telling me you will receive at some later time using the present as a sort of referring to the future?
Yeah. So I think it's the latter. If you were to kind of woodenly translate it, you might say like, you are receiving the good houses from God. And, you know, the sense there, I think Robertson's grammar uses, you know, I wasn't familiar with this terminology, but he calls it an inchoative or conative present. So like an example he gives is John 10:32, where the present is used when Jesus says, you know, I've shown you many good works from the Father. For which of these are you going to stone me? Lithazete, right? So present, kind of that same future sense, but it's still present tense, you know, because they haven't received the houses yet. But yeah, so it's something that is going to happen.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, so in, you know, the linguistics, semantics world, people have noted this use of the present. It's very, very common across many languages. People call it a futurate. And the way, the reason you can do it, I mean, you can do it in English all the time. You know, something like the game is coming on tonight, right? Mm-hmm. Where tonight hasn't happened yet, but we're using a, you know, present progressive, the game is coming on. And the reason why we can do it is because it's some sort of like schedule or already determined sort of thing. So I, again, when I'm reading it, right, I don't know what you're thinking. so that's why, you know, I'm sort of asking these questions, but that's great. So another one, so this is lesson 18, page 80, you have hupo stephonta pros oikon. So why pros oikon and not ace oikon? Pros is normally used for movement towards a person and ace towards a location. So why, you know, pros and not ace here?
Yeah, I think I looked back at this and, you know, it's probably something that would have been better with ace. It's comprehensible what it means, but probably I think ace would have fit better. I mean, just be more idiomatic with how it's used in the Septuagint and New Testament.
Yeah. I think that's a totally valid answer. I was wondering, I'm not sure about this. You know, sometimes you can have some kinds of nouns stand in for people, like oikon, you know, could in theory be like family or household and that kind of thing. I didn't know if there were examples of that. I mean, I, you know, there is this pretty like robust distinction in Koine between this pros ace thing towards a person or towards a location. But there are some nouns that behave either like people or locations. So that was one of the reasons for asking.
I think your question brings up a really good point about prepositions and especially ace, because I feel like in most introductory Koine classes, students learn that as just into, you know, so it's always into. So when they see it with something else that you can't really go into, they get confused. So there's understanding that it can be used in a lot of different ways. I think that's helpful.
Yeah. I mean, it's really the argument against just the whole glossing thing. You know, it's just like, it's just not the same as into. Great. So just a couple of more of these questions about the Greek. So this is lesson 27, page 116, line 5. So you have hethugater en and not en hethugater. So, you know, the copula obviously can be used in either order. The en up front would be something similar to a cleft sentence in English. It is, right? Rather than the daughter is. In the context, I felt like that made more sense. So why hethugater en here and not the other way around?
Yeah, it's a good question. From what I can tell in copula sentences in Greek, I think the predicate is often before the copula. So here, hethugater, I was thinking that it would be the predicate. I guess one example I found was John 12:6, where it says, al hoti kleptes en, but he was a thief. And we already know who's being talked about here. And the point in this story, so in lesson 27, line 5, is that the person here was Philemon's daughter and not someone else, right? So it's not just, oh, it was his daughter, but that's who it was, not someone else. Because the sentence before, as Philemon, it says that Philemon heard someone approaching. And then, hethugater en, right? So that it, kind of trying to make a distinction it was the daughter, it wasn't someone else approaching. Yeah, I mean, maybe another example might be James 5:17 has Elias anthropos en homeopathes hemin, right? So Elijah was a person like us, you know? So yeah, I don't know. That's kind of what I was thinking, but, you know, happy to discuss, like, maybe it'd be better the other way, or yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting. It's a difficult question for several reasons. I mean, I think obviously in Greek you do have a focused position towards the front of the clause, right? So if you are trying to contrast it, you know, with something else, mm-hmm. I think that does make sense. In English, right, we can use the cleft construction for focus. So we can say, like, it was the daughter, right? Where the it is not really a normal subject, right? It has no content. And then the daughter is the thing that is actually in a focus position. Mm. So in Greek, the question, I would have to check these sort of cleft constructions. I think you do have cleft constructions. Well, you do, right? In Greek, where you have the copula first and you have a difference in accenting for estin, right? Estin. The question is whether there it's also used for focus. So I mean, honestly, I think your answer is totally comprehensible. The reason why you would do it, if you're focusing the daughter, you put it first and then you put the copula. I don't know in Greek, again, so this is just kind of me talking out loud right now. If the cleft construction with estin or and first can also be this focus construction. But, you know, anyone out there that knows the answer to this is welcome to correct me on this, or tell me the answer.
I would love to know too. You know, that would help in the future if I continue to write different things in Greek. Just, you know, we're all trying to improve, you know, so.
Yeah, no, for sure. None of us are native speakers, so everyone has room for improvement.
Yeah.
So another question on that same page, you have, this is line 16. So you have, he de Thecla, which is a name, me eduia ten parabolen ton carpon apen. So she doesn't know the parable. So why eduia here and not suniesa, you know, understand?
Yeah, I think the more common way of, you know, saying understand would be the verb suniemi and suniesa, right? So when I was writing, I tried to limit myself to words used in Kroi. Suniemi wasn't introduced yet. Well, it's not introduced in the book at all. Oida is, I think it might have been in this lesson. I'm not exactly sure, but also the participial phrase me eduia is made comprehensible by what Thecla says, you know, when she's speaking and she says ukoida, right? So you have the same verb kind of in different forms, both helping to make them both comprehensible. So give them practice with the verb. But also, I think my standard was, if it helps the students and it's in the New Testament, then I'll use it.
Yeah.
So, you know, oida is not commonly, but it is used in Mark 4:13 with understanding parables. So it's kind of what I went on.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. So what was the example you said, Mark 4:13?
Mark 4:13.
Okay. Where you have oida tan parabolen or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, so I think again, this is a very, you know, helpful thing for people to understand when reading through the book, right? That the point is that you do have this construction does exist, right? But even if it isn't the most idiomatic way to say it, it's the most helpful for the student in this case. And I completely agree with you. I didn't realize that you had that phrase, oida ten parabolen. So that's actually really, really good to know. Even though, you know, obviously these sorts of, like, knowing predicates can have these kind of, this sort of overlap. Yeah, so that's really helpful. So just a couple other grammatical explanations. Again, you mentioned this earlier. For anyone that hasn't seen the book, you have these stories usually on the left-hand side, and then the grammatical explanations on the right with, you know, glosses for uncommon words. So just in general, what guided you to include or what to include in these sorts of grammatical explanations?
Yeah, so I think I wanted to, as much as possible, keep it consistent with what they were learning in Kroi. So I wanted to keep the explanation short and simple, and I wanted the notes to help them understand the passage. So, you know, I try not to kind of go into more advanced debates about grammar and things like that. I wanted to keep it short, simple, and reinforce what they were learning. And Croy itself has a grammar. It's very concise, the explanations he gives. So I kind of try to follow that principle.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. So just a couple of questions about your notes. On page 93, note 32, you say that Okuo is deponent in the future. So I know there's a lot of debate about deponency. We do have a podcast episode on it, kind of defending the term. So I'm not really picking on you for using the word deponent, as some people would, but is Okuo really deponent, and how do you define that? So deponent specifically in the future. So, you know, there are some verbs we know, right, that only have a middle form in the future. So for example, phagomai, you'll never see phago or estheso, right? That those forms don't exist. So what do you mean by deponent, and why do you say Okuo is deponent in the future?
Yeah, I think that I was following, you know, I have to go back and look. It's been a while, but I'm pretty sure that it's an example that Croy gives for verbs in the future that are in the middle, but don't have a middle sense. Therefore, they're deponent. And he doesn't give a really extended discussion of deponent. You know, I think what he says is just that, comes from the Latin, the word itself, deponent, comes from the Latin, and just means that kind of doesn't have a middle sense understood as active. I mean, personally, I'm not a huge fan of the term. I'd love to hear your podcast episode. I'm not a huge fan of the term deponent, that's used for verbs without an active present tense, because I think when it's usually used, it seems to imply that these verbs are irregular according to a certain standard of Greek morphology, when in fact they're very common. Words. Now, I use the term because since it's aimed at beginners, it's a beginner level book, and I tried to keep it consistent with Croy's terminology. So I think that was my guiding principle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think part of this is actually a difference in terminology. So, you know, the way I would use it and the way most linguists would use it is it's more of a morphological term and not a semantic term. So what you're saying is you call it deponent because there's a middle form that is semantically more active, right? Or something like that. You know, obviously defining what semantically active means is tricky in and of itself. But if you define it morphologically and just say there are verbs without corresponding active forms, then it's just a category of morphology. It's just a fact, right? It's just a fact that you have erchomai and not ercho. And so whatever we call those things doesn't really matter. But I think, again, even in linguistic studies, this is what people call them, right? They call them deponent verbs. So to be consistent with, you know, the wider grammatical studies world, and to just, if you just change our definition slightly, this is it's not a debatable category. It's just a reality that there are some verbs that, you know, have this middle or passive voice without a corresponding active form. So it's helpful to see then that you are using it as a more traditional New Testament Greek grammatical studies definition, mm-hmm. right? Of any sort of middle form with an active meaning, right? Yeah.
That's right.
Oh. Yeah. Great. Yeah. So, and again, there's a lot, of people that have a lot of opinions about this, but
oh, yeah.
So just a couple other ones and then we'll wrap up here. So lesson 23, this is page 99, note 4. You talk about epi and pros, and epi being used. Again, this is one of these preposition things. You have epi, you know, plus the accusative with movement towards someone. So most examples of epi plus the accusative usually involve like downward movement. So why did you choose epi and not pros here in this context?
Yeah, so for this one, I chose epi because I wanted to show, again, the flexibility of prepositions and how some prepositions are used in certain ways with specific verbs. So in this case, because the verb is hypostrepho plus epitina is sometimes used with a returning to someone. So Bidag gives the example of from Shepherd of Hermas, 29:7. I can read it in Greek here. It says, it's talking about, I'm not sure of the wider context, but it says, Telese epiton heltes andra hypostrepsai. Right. So she wants to return to her own husband. So there, epi with hypostrepho used for returning to someone. So that's kind of one place where it's used. And I think it's with the particular verb hypostrepho here where it's used in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Those are always the best examples where you have all of the necessary elements, the right verb and, you know, the preposition and stuff. So last kind of content question here, then I will stop bugging you about all of these questions. So page 123, note 31. So you have the sentence, uk efagon uden, and you say double negatives add emphasis and do not cancel each other in Greek. So it means they ate nothing. So what do you mean by emphasis here? I know this is like a word that's just kind of thrown around. You know, and what are you trying to teach people when, you know, when you're teaching about this sort of double negative construction?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I feel like you said, emphasis is kind of thrown around without much explanation. And it's hard because I think that it's something you can say, like, oh, here, you know, whether this example or in other cases where the word emphasis is used in reconstruction, you can say this adds emphasis, but you don't really know what that means unless you've seen it a lot of times. And, you know, you kind of get a sense for what kind of emphasis is implied in the different cases, you know? So I think what I mean here is, I think that it strengthens the negation. So, you know, I guess if you woodenly translated it, maybe you could translate it as they nothing at all. You know, I probably wouldn't go that far to translate it that way, but has that kind of sense to it. Another example might be, so 1 John 1:5 says, "Kais otia en auto ukastin udemia." So you know, some English translations will translate that as, "In him there's no darkness at all," right? So that kind of emphasis there. But you know, even the "at all," it's a way that we're trying to represent in English the emphasis that may be there in Greek, but it's not like an exact one-to-one correspondence. So yeah, I don't know if that helps, or you know, if you have any pushback or thoughts on that.
Yeah. This is something. So I again, just interviewed in a podcast, a lady named Chiara Gionolo, and she works on these sort of double negative constructions in Greek. So I'm not an expert in negation, but the typical sort of analysis in semantics for strengthened negatives or with something called negative polarity items, you know, where you have, you know, so the way to do it in English, the easiest way is to use any. So I didn't eat anything means that basically that you're canceling out the alternative options that you think that the this hearer thinks might be fringe options. Right. So that's kind of the like standard analysis of emphasized negation. She actually said that this sort of construction doesn't do that. But it's more of a syntax thing where you have uden is what's called a negative concord item. And it just like agrees basically with something with the negative item. You know, so she's a native speaker of Italian, and in Italian, it apparently works the same way as koine. What's interesting about this here, right, is in English, again, if you gloss it, uk efagon uden, you would always, you know, you'd want to try to gloss that last word. And I think you gloss it like I ate nothing, right? Or they ate nothing. I can't remember who the subject is. Yeah, I think it's an important thing here because this is different than how English does it. And, you know, again, I think more work needs to be done on, you know, exactly why this construction is used and not just like, you know, uk efagon. Right. But I know people again throw around the emphasis word, but I think it's a helpful thing to tell students, right? Because if their native language doesn't do this, you know, it's a very typical thing to just say, oh, okay, like this is emphasized, and then we just kind of move on from there. Yeah. So do you have any last thoughts on these sort of grammatical explanations or constructions?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just going back to that last point, you know, as you were talking, I was just thinking about examples in Korean And actually, Korean uses double negatives very similarly as well. So like, you know, you might say like, I didn't know like nothing, you know, but until you mentioned that, I never realized that in Korean they do that, because I just understood it as like they don't know, you know. So I think that just points to the fact that, like, you know, as English speakers learning Greek, we're trying to like analyze how this is different from English and how it exactly corresponds or translate, or not exactly, but how it corresponds to English. But, you know, for a native Koine Greek speaker, they would have just kind of been confused and been like, it just means they didn't eat anything.
Right.
So, yeah, I think, again, that points to the need to try and acquire Greek as Greek, and that requires a lot of input and, you know, other things. And yeah.
So do you feel like there is this emphasis in Korean?
You know, I'd have to put more thought into it, you know, because I've never like analyzed it before, you know, I just use it as speech. Perhaps there is, but yeah, I can't say with confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really interesting, because there are all sorts of ways we can, you know, do it in English. Like, I didn't eat anything, I ate nothing, right? Where you actually don't have a negation, I ate, and then nothing, you're canceling out the thing that you ate. I didn't eat anything is, you know, like I said, a negative polarity item at the end. There's all sorts of different constructions. The question is like, what do these things all mean, right? Yeah. And it's something that a native speaker of Koine, like you said, would just be like, oh, I know exactly what they mean. You are, I don't know, are you a native speaker of Korean?
I grew up speaking it, but
okay. So but you're still, you know, understanding this, and I never thought about this, right? Until it's brought to your attention, right. And it's the same way, right? In Koine, you know, people would have just automatically said, "Oh, this is what it means." Without access to this, we really all are on the same page, right? Just saying, okay, let's look at all the context, right, and try to figure out, you know, what this thing is doing, and then we're just giving, you know, sort of our best guess based on all the data. And, you know, sometimes our best guess is a quite good guess, right? Mm-hmm. But at other times it's very hard, especially with these kinds of things, that the nuances are just so subtle. I mean, that's actually, you know, what I talked to Kiara about is, you know, it's very, very hard to know with these kinds of things what the quote unquote correct analysis is, the analysis that would really reflect the native speaker.
Yeah.
Great. So I think I've drilled you enough on these things. So just a couple of concluding questions. How did writing these stories help your Greek personally?
Yeah, I think they definitely helped me think more about Greek use, like how words are used in Greek. That's a very general statement, but just, I mean, even a lot of the questions we've talked about here, a lot of those questions came up as I was writing, you know, would this be how a Greek person would say it? And is this idiomatic in Greek? So I, you know, just asking those questions as I was writing really helped me to search for answers and also refine my understanding of grammar in certain areas and vocabulary and things like that. So I think that really helped, and also just helped me connect more with the language because I was putting my own thoughts and expressing them in Greek. I think it helped me, yeah, have a more personal connection, if that makes sense, with Greek. And it also was fun to do. So it helped me want to continue to learn more Greek and get better at Greek.
Yeah. Yeah. I, again, as someone who does something very similar, I would just say it's immensely beneficial to see what you're a little bit shaky on, you know, because when you're writing it, you realize, oh, is this right? Right. You kind of question yourself and say, okay, I'm actually not sure about this construction. Whereas when you're reading it, you often just kind of gloss over, you know, those kinds of questions. So the last question, we've said that, you know, we need more texts like this. And you said people should just take a stab at writing it. How would you recommend students, you know, practice to get to the point where they can, you know, write their own stories in Greek? I mean, there is a sort of minimum threshold of competency required to be writing original Koine texts. So, you know, you've kind of shared some of your journey about how you got there. What would you recommend to people to get there themselves?
Yeah, I would say use the native Koine Greek speakers that we have available as models to write your own Greek. So they're not alive today, but their texts are with us. You have the New Testament, you have other Koine texts. Use those as models for you when you're starting to write and construct your own sentences. So I did a lot of that with writing these stories. You know, I would look at the Gospels and how things were presented in the Gospels and, you know, try and edit those stories or put them in my own words so that I wasn't just starting from zero. I mean, sometimes I did just write free flow, and that was good practice too. But especially if you're more at a beginner level or kind of maybe an advanced beginner, you know, I think that's a good place to start. Usually even in, you know, modern language classrooms, if you're writing or speaking, you have enough examples from native speakers, native people's writing that you can use to write your own materials. So yeah, but I would also say, like, just try it, you know, and see what comes out, and, you know, and then you can, the good thing about writing is that you can always go back and fix it, you know, which is a little different maybe from speaking, where you're communicating on the spot. You know, of course you can get feedback and improve as well, but with writing, it's kind of, you can be a little bit more methodical or careful with it. So
yeah, I think it's a great sort of litmus test for where you are in the language. So this is really helpful. Again, we just highly recommend anyone out there, if you're interested in simple Koine texts, this is a great resource for people to dive in. I mean, really, regardless of whether you're using Croy or not, you need lots of simple texts that are on your level. So yeah, I would highly recommend this resource from Mark Jung. Do you have anything else to add?
No, thank you so much for having me on here. And I'm really interested in checking out Biblingo as well. It seems really cool.
Great. Yeah. So that's all we have time for on this episode of the Biblical Languages Podcast. Thank you, Mark, for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you to all of our listeners out there who have taken the time to listen to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Thank you for listening to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review. You can also follow Biblingo on social media to discuss the episode with us and other listeners. And don't forget to visit biblingo.org to start your 10-day free trial of Biblingo.